Coming up on the Mindful Midlife Crisis.
Basic life 101, move or die. Even if you think about what is the best thing to do to prevent dementia and brain deterioration, it is more sophisticated movement patterns. You want your grandma to have a sharper brain? Put her in a dance class. Teach them how to do different dexterity things with their fingers, play a new instrument, all that kind of stuff. Their brain's going to light up because the first line of code is to move or die. And that is something that we cannot forget, that movement creates vitality, and vitality is the currency that moves us through life and all the things we're trying to get from it.
Welcome to the Mindful Midlife Crisis, a podcast for people navigating the complexities and possibilities of life's second half. I'm your host, Billy Lahr, an educator, personal trainer, meditation teacher, and overthinker who talks to experts who specialize in social and emotional learning, mindfulness, physical and emotional wellness, cultural awareness, finances, communication, relationships, dating, and parenting, all in an effort to help us better reflect, learn, and grow so we can live a more purpose-filled life. Take a deep breath, embrace the present, and journey with me through the Mindful Midlife Crisis. Welcome to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. I'm your host, Billy. Thank you for tuning in this week, wherever you are. Shout out to our listeners in Birmingham, England. I love it when we go international. Auckland, New Zealand. We got both sides of the world over here. Thank you very much. Coast to coast, literally the world over. Coast to coast in the United States as well. Hialeah, Florida. Am I saying that correctly, Hialeah, Florida? Let me know if I am. San Jose, California, thanks for tuning in. Charlotte, North Carolina, thank you as well for tuning in. Thank you, all of you, for tuning in. I really appreciate that. That means a lot. Hey, if you want a shout out, send a message to mindfulmidlifecrisis@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at mindful_midlife_crisis. You can also go to www.mindfulmidlifecrisis.com and click on the contact page and hit us up there. We're also on Twitter at Mindful Midlife, and we're on Facebook at the Mindful Midlife Crisis Podcast. You can find all of this in our show notes and on our website. If you do go to our website, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter under Contact. We send out a different mindfulness meditation each Sunday, along with information about the Reflect, Learn, Grow program my coaching partner Jill Daler and I created. If you want to learn more about that, you can click on the Reflect, Learn, Grow link in the show notes of this episode. We put important things in the show notes, people. Make sure you're looking. The newsletter also updates you on upcoming events hosted by our amazing guests who also are seeking out opportunities to help you reflect, learn, and grow. There's some other goodies in there as well that you may want to check out. So if any of that piques your curiosity, be sure to sign up for the newsletter at www.mindfulmidlifecrisis.com under Contacts. If you would like to support our show, be sure to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, be sure to click on the little plus sign in the upper right-hand corner. Or if you're a Spotify user, click follow under our cover art. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Also, you can go to the show notes and click on leave us a review and leave us a 5-star review. Even if you're not a regular listener and you've only listened to an episode here and there, tell us what you liked about your favorite episode. It can be as simple as, I really enjoyed episode 59 with Rich Bracken about the emotional intelligence dance party. That's actually a really fun one. When you leave us a 5-star review, not only does it help others find the show, but it also fills my heart with happiness and joy. But the best way to support this show is to share it with others. Be sure to tag us if you share it on Instagram at mindful_midlife_crisis. If you use Twitter, tag us at Mindful Midlife. And if you're a Facebook user, you can tag us at the Mindful Midlife Crisis Podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media for all the latest. This week's episode focuses on health, wellness, and fitness. So if you want more episodes like that, be sure to check out our 2-part episode 6 with Maurice Buchanan and Delico James from Work Gym, one of our favorite conversations. You can also check out episode 50 with Aaron Boyke, where we discuss the importance of strength training as we age. Don't I know it? I'm a NASM certified personal trainer, and I love talking to other personal trainers because the good ones out there will shoot you straight, and today's guest is no different. Our guest today is Eric Romanak. Eric is a fitness instructor and a social entrepreneur at Siva Fitness Academy in Kentucky. Eric is also the author of Live Better, Die Slower, The Key to Making Health and Fitness Really Stick, and is also the co-host of A Therapist and a Trainer podcast. Eric grew up an overweight child of divorce and struggled significantly with bullying, anger, and depression. By age 22, he had already been divorced, filed for bankruptcy, and was a college dropout. Over the next 25 years, he has been on a journey of self-discovery, which has led him to become a health and fitness professional. He has been a certified instructor in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, yoga, tactical fitness, strength training, nutrition, and run coaching. I love this all-around fitness approach right here. His primary passion is now helping people reframe and prioritize health in their lives in a way that's sustainable and permanent. He's been married to his first health coach, Denise, for 22 years and has two children he adores. He spends his free time marathon training. That I don't appreciate. He unapologetically drinks bourbon every night, loves Skeletor memes, and recently got his first cat. What a renaissance, man. Welcome to the show, Eric Romanak.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's a lot that I want to dive into here today, almost to the point before we get to the 10 roles, but maybe they'll come out in the 10 roles. So let's do this. We always have our guests talk about what 10 roles they play in their life. So what are the 10 roles that you play?
Well, that was a really hard question to ask. I got, you know, husband, obviously. My wife and I have always said our relationship is the center of it all. It's how it all started. So we'll stay true to the core. So I always say I'm a husband first, and then I'm a father. And then professionally, you know, I extend out into a trainer, fitness instructor, and a health coach. And then that's a run. I love being a runner. That's my passion. I'm a shoe enthusiast. That's the material side of my enjoyment. I am a, I'm a professional asshole. It's the most correct way to describe me. I also like to be honest. I'm a recovering piece of shit. That is
that makes two of us.
Yeah. I'm a recovering overthinker as well.
Yeah, same here.
I am a creator, as we all are. I'm an aspiring tinker and apparel company CEO. I just went ahead and threw that out there.
I do like that. We definitely are going to talk about that a little bit more. I feel like the recovering piece of shit we're going to dive into deeper in the next segment. So we'll save that. That definitely has my attention. I imagine it has our listeners' attention too. Let's talk about really quickly a professional asshole. Why are you hating on yourself, man? Why do you call yourself a professional asshole?
Well, I think my mind definitely jumps into seeing things very directly. I think maybe that's part of protective mechanism when I was a child, but then it turned into, you know, when you take martial arts, you just learn there's some very no-nonsense things about living, and you tend to side with those because it helps you more. And then as a health coach, you definitely need to help people realize things on their own terms, but sometimes you have to, you know, I heard my favorite quote is, you know, a mentor and a coach is like a fire. It warms you and it burns you.
Oh, so, I like that.
You just have to have that role. It has to be a little bit natural to you. And I'm not going to say that I'm a super nice guy all the time, but I do have a big heart and I have a lot of empathy for people. But, and it's, you know, the parent in you as well learns that kids need a little bit of that reality check and delivered the right way, of course, but it still always hurts. And people point that out.
It's funny that you mentioned this because now, as you kind of elaborate on that, you can hear that tone in the podcast that you host, A Trainer and a Therapist. You can hear that tone in there. And yeah, you come off as someone who has a big heart, but you're also going to shoot it straight. So that's something that I always appreciate. I like when people speak clearly, they're clear in their message, that kind of thing. So I appreciate that. So, you know, I don't know that you're a professional asshole so much as just a straight shooter. We'll put it that way.
Maybe. It depends how well you know me.
I guess the question is, you know, if you're a bourbon lover, how much does the asshole then come out?
You know, actually, I get quite happy when I've had a couple of bourbons in me. I grew up and there's a lot of alcoholism in my family, and I saw the dark side of alcoholism. I don't drink to for that kind of release. I drink as a symbolic end of the day, and or as I like to tell people also that I'm just kind of, I really just want a reason to mix it with Coca-Cola. And I know that's blasphemy for a lot of people, but as a runner, high fructose corn syrup is like heroin. It goes straight to my liver. And my wife's just like, well, why don't you just drink a Coke at the end of the night? I said, I'll drink it in 20 seconds. So the bourbon actually makes me enjoy the Coca-Cola. And I just had, it's just this little hour window of being happy. So I'm unapologetic about it. And plus, I believe that I don't believe in sainthood and being a monk in this health and fitness stuff. If your body can't handle some toxins, you're weak.
Says the guy who wrote the book, Live Better, Die Slower.
There's the live better side.
You're on don't the live better that. Side. Oh, that's fantastic. So here, let's take a look at the three roles that you're most looking forward to in the second half of life. The first thing you said was husband. What are you looking forward to in the second half of life when it comes to being a husband?
Yeah, I got one kid in college now. My daughter's a senior. So my wife and I are getting, you know, the preview of next phase of empty nesting, you know, just really kind of, we're almost like dating again. We've had a great relationship and we continue to, and it's just, you know, something I really want to look forward to and just continue growing with her in a new phase, growing older with her and seeing what that looks like.
I actually just had a conversation with a certified financial planner, Matt Moline, and that episode is going to air later this season. I don't really have everything all planned out. I think that one's coming out in like December, but he has a book out called Empty Nest, Full Pockets. And that's what we talked about in the show. So as someone who's about to become an empty nester, you might want to check that out. I can probably score you a copy. In fact, if you listen to that episode, this is for all you listeners out there, there's going to be a free copy of the book in the show notes. So I tell you guys all the time, look at the show notes. There's worthwhile stuff in there. Check it out. Nice. And Eric, you're right there, man. You're on the cusp of being an empty nester.
Yeah, I like that title.
I do too. And it's actually a really funny book too. Like you would think he's going to talk about financial planning. It's very funny. It has a lot of anecdotes about his journey to being an empty nester. And Matt is just 100% a real good dude. You're looking forward to being a runner as well. Talk about that. What is it about running that do you get the runner's high?
Yeah. I mean, I know what that is. You know, with endurance sports, you can peak in your 50s. It's one of those things where it's a very, very straightforward metric. I am still ratcheting up and setting PRs, personal records. And that feels, you know, at our age, when you're still getting better and still definitively growing, that's something that you really latch onto and invest more time in. And running does that for me.
It's interesting that you're looking forward to running because I think of that as the most basic form of exercise. But meanwhile, you are also a certified instructor in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, yoga, tactical fitness. So what is it about running that makes you look forward to that in the second half of life? Is it just really the longevity piece?
Yeah. Well, I've been instructors in all those things. I haven't done Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in quite a few years. And the running has a symbolic attachment to it. You know, the life is a marathon, not a sprint. It's a very, very true thing. You're learning how to endure. You're learning how to put one foot in front of the other over and over and over. The redundancy, you know, that people can't handle. And I couldn't either at one time. I mean, I definitely feel like I have some severe ADD. And this has been something that's just been almost like a religion to me, as in rewiring my brain. That's really the thing that stands out as a runner, is what it does to my worldview of how my life is, the reality of life. And you just kind of have to just go. And then some days are diamonds, some days are rocks, and every race is different. And sometimes you train for things for 18 weeks and then you wake up and the race day comes and it's torrential downpour, it's windy, it's 90 degrees, you know, disappointment's there. And it's just a great thing to cope with.
I love that. And it really is true that running, and especially marathon running, it embodies the life metaphor perfectly. You said that you're also looking forward to being an aspiring tinkerer and apparel company CEO. So are you a hands-on kind of guy, or are you handy in the garage? What does that mean, aspiring tinkerer? Are you tinkering now, or are you hoping to somewhere along the line?
Yeah, I think when you're in your late 20s and 30s, I wasn't able to really do some of the handiwork around the house to the degree that I would have appreciated. It's like now I have the time to appreciate the value of doing those things more and more. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it's really good for my mental health to have projects that aren't overwhelming. You know, we remodeled our whole house when my kids were two and just and newborn, and I hated it. It was awful. I give anything to have some of those projects back now. The apparel CEO thing is just kind of a cheeky thing that my wife's going to give me a bunch of shit about. I've been a service provider for a long time as a health coach. It's all about relationships and helping people, and I love it, but it's also exhausting. I would not mind making a living in a simple transaction. Like, here's some running shorts. You want them? Great. Buy them. That's it. You know, looking at trying to create a business from the bottom line and from the manufacturing and that side of making a living is kind of something that I haven't been able to do for a long time because I've been in this industry.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because working in education, you're constantly interacting with people. And for you, not only are you interacting with them, but you also have to do the sales pitch of it too. I didn't have to do that so much, but when you're teaching, you have 30 kids in a classroom 3 to 5 times a day, right? So that level of interaction can really be exhausting. And so it would be nice to just kind of have some sort of passive income where you had this set up and then you didn't have to worry about it. It was just sort of a set it and forget it kind of approach.
Yeah. I told you I was a shoe enthusiast. I love running clothes. I love running attire. It's just what you end up getting into. And it's kind of like, oh, I'd like to make my own because that'd be exactly what I want it to be. So, you know, there's a little bit of, I still would have a passionate approach to it, I'm sure. I mean, selling exercise is hard, man. People are paying you damn good money to come in and you make them suffer. Usually the people who can afford it are not natural athletes per se. You know, those people don't pay for personal trainers. They just go out and do their thing. These are people who don't really like to exercise, and hell, I don't blame them. So, but that's a hard sell every day. You sell them every time.
Well, when you get that apparel up and running, we'll put that on the website, and then, you know, we'll be a distributor for your apparel as well. Obviously.
Thanks,
yeah, absolutely. We'll take 90% off the top. You can have the 10% for your creative purposes.
Perfect.
Seal it. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to continue talking to Eric. We're going to learn more about this philosophy behind live better and die slower. Thank you for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis. This episode of The Mindful Midlife Crisis is sponsored by Newsly. Newsly is an all-in-one audio super app for iOS and Android. Newsly picks up the most trending articles on the web about topics you choose at any given moment and reads them to you in a natural human voice, not a computer voice. The entire web becomes listenable for the first time all in one place. You can follow any topic as specific as you like, from sports, tech, business, science, Bitcoin, mindfulness, midlife crises, paddleboarding, whatever you're in the mood for. Newsly will find you the latest articles and read them to you aloud. You're getting older, people. Save your eyeballs while still working your brain. Newsly also has podcasts like this one as well. You can explore all sorts of trending podcasts from over 80 countries. They even have digital radio, so you can stay up to date on your favorite 90s jams so you can rock out with Brian on the bass at the next Gen X Jukebox show. Sound good to you? Then download the app on your phone or visit www.newsly.me. That's www.newsly.me, which will be linked in the show notes, so you can start using Newsly for free now. All you got to do is download the app and use the promo code MindfulMidlife, and you'll get a free 1 month premium subscription. Again, that's promo code MindfulMidlife for a free 1 month premium subscription. Stop scrolling. Start listening with Newsly.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. If you're enjoying what you've heard so far, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Also, giving the show a quick 5-star review with a few kind words helps others find and benefit from this podcast just like you are. Finally, please spread the wealth of free knowledge and advice in this episode by sharing it with the people in your life who may find this information and my mission to help others live a more purpose-filled life valuable. My hope is that these conversations resonate with others and inspire people to live their best lives. Thanks again. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. We are here with personal trainer and business owner, Eric Romanak. He is also the co-host of a therapist and trainer podcast. And we're going to talk about his book, Live Better, Die Slower, The Key to Making Health and Fitness Finally Stick. Let's just start right off the bat here, Eric. Let's talk about what are the principles of Live Better, Die Slower that you outline in your book.
It's pretty simple. I mean, the title's there. I think it's all predicated on the idea that you're going to die. And when you finally just really swallow that pill, then anxiety goes down a little bit. A little bit of impetus to live a certain type of life, it increases. And one of the first things that people have to realize is, you know, before you are a husband or a wife or a doctor, lawyer, whatever you identify as, you are first and foremost a biological machine. And that biological machine runs on certain principles. Treat it well, it feels better. If you feel better, you have a better outlook on life and you usually do better things. When it feels like crap, you usually start to have a little bit more of a shadowed lens on how you view the world, and your relationships can reflect that as well. So it really comes down to health being, you know, one of the central pillars of your human existence. And if the machine's broken, the quality of your life, it really becomes an issue. And it's almost a moral duty. There was a quote from Samuel Johnson one time, and I kind of built my business on this, and it said, to preserve health is a moral duty, or you can no longer be useful when you are not well. So we hear about people pulling their weight in this world and providing value, and all that stuff's really important. But I think people forget that is if you can only do that when you're young, 30 years old, and then you're done, you know, then you're become a burden to the system as opposed to something that adds value, you know, that's kind of on you. It's not just, oh, I'm old. Well, yeah, you got old, but how fast did you get old? Did you take care of yourself? Because you are the hub of the wheel of your life. When you break down, the quality of the spokes that generate outward into your family and loved ones and professional relationships, those start to deteriorate as well. You can't provide the way you used to. And the way the body is, yeah, it does deteriorate, but you can step on the accelerator or you can pump the brakes a little bit. And that's a matter of taking care of yourself. There's a reason classic cars are still on the road.
It's funny that you bring up, you know, that idea of how are you aging? Because definitely I'm 45 and there are young 45-year-olds. I kind of feel young-ish. You know, I don't necessarily feel 45 and there are old 45-year-olds. I think one of the nicest backhanded compliments that I got when I was in Korea was we were hiking up a mountain and I just skirted up this rock face and was standing, you know, overlooking the city. This one guy goes, well, you move pretty good for an older guy. I'm like, you son of a bitch. Thank you. Yeah. That was very nice. So during an episode of your podcast with your co-host, Justin Lewis, you ask listeners, do you have your foot on the gas pedal towards death? And it sounds like that was you in your 20s. So can you talk about some of the mistakes you made during that time and what the wake-up call was for you?
There's a human tendency just, and I learned this in martial arts too, is that, you know, humans are very reflexive. If we're not trained to think differently, we just kind of bounce around based off of emotions and moods and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I grew up, my parents got divorced when I was 6, and you know, I had a lot of anger and anxiety, and which was really, these were all symptoms of a depression. And I've numbed myself starting with food at age 7 and then turned into nicotine and then turned into whatever else I can get my hands on to numb myself. I was always chasing numbness and stimulation. Really had zero direction whatsoever. Now, a lot of people left to their own devices, you know, we can never outgrow that. We go get a job, but we're just constantly, whatever is in our face, we're always in fire drill mode. You ever notice in traffic when people are driving and, you know, they start driving aggressively and they speed up, it's, you know, it's like just city traffic, and they speed up and then hit their brakes hard at the next red light. That's the way a lot of people live. They're not cruising through life at a certain pace where there's certain, where I can handle things. They're just gas, brake, gas, brake, gas, brake. And it's exhausting. And that's how I was living my life. And my first wife, I call it my practice marriage. We were married for like, 8 months. No, but seriously, I'm 21 years old. I think we got married just to have a wedding. I think we were bored. Once again, just trying to be stimulated. And from there, she left, thank God, because I was terrible and I needed it and she needed something else. So I'm now all of a sudden, now I'm alone. And we had filed bankruptcy like a couple months before, because when I went to college, they gave me a bunch of stupid credit cards and I didn't know what to do, but I knew I spend money because that was stimulating. And 260 pounds, like 80 pounds heavier than I am now, is completely overweight. And I dropped out of college and was working restaurant gigs and just that. And that was the wake up call, man. And I'm lonely now. Who the hell's going to want me? I was a horny 21 year old and I looked in the mirror and I looked like shit. And I was a piece of shit. That moment, I was like, I admitted to myself, you are a piece of shit. Who's going to love you? And it was accurate. My therapist might not agree with that's the way to handle it, but that is exactly the way I needed to handle it, because I was telling myself 100 other things besides that. So then from then on, I just haphazardly tried to do a little bit better and I failed miserably and tried a lot of different paths. And, you know, finally health, my own personal health and taking care of myself ended up being the big game changer, that along with my family.
So what was the start then? What did you get into? Did you just start walking a little bit more? We talked to Aaron Boyke in, I think it's episode 50, and he talked about, like, he was a chubby kid too, and he just started with walking around the corner, and then it just kind of gradually turned into running a little bit here and there. So what were your baby steps into feeling physically better?
When I got married to my wife, I was a bartender smoking cigarettes and drinking Mountain Dew still. But she was had just bought her first house and was training to qualify for the Boston Marathon. And she told me, yeah, I'm like, what did you do this morning? She's like, I ran 10 miles. I'm like, what? You know, I just absolutely never heard of anybody who did this before. I mean, I knew it of marathons, but I never knew a marathoner. And my wife was the first person who I used as a model of kind of, oh, this person has their shit together. She never tried to get me to exercise at all. That was the thing I loved about her. She was very patient. She just loved me for who I was. I was playing a lot of music back then and I was funny and charming. So I was providing something in her life that wasn't normal. Then after we had our first kid, I was really kind of heavy and anxious. And then I remember going out and putting on some New Balance shoes, you know, that I had in my closet and running from mailbox to mailbox. And then the next day I ran to 3 mailboxes, you know, and it just kind of added that way. And that was my first time I ever really started to feel good about, you know, exercising. But it wasn't until we moved that I got into martial arts. I started taking a class and then things really, really unraveled there. I was a stay-at-home dad at the time. So my wife would come down from work and she would say, hey, I'm done working. You go do something for you. So I started taking classes and classes turned into this thing I'm doing now.
So just kind of going back, you know, you talked about being a recovering piece of shit and going from what you call your practice wife to your wife now. What changes did you make internally, externally, that made you feel maybe worthy of love or something like that? Or was that never, ever part of it? Is it so long ago that you're like, I don't even remember?
Yeah. There's been countless adjustments and realignments that I have gone through and continue to go through, that's for sure. I will say that the biggest, and this is one of those principles that I talk about a lot with my clients and in that book, is that you find out through martial arts that your mind isn't driving the bus. Your nervous system is driving the bus. You are a caveman with an iPhone. You live in a modern world, but you are running on primal software. And when you start to get into things like sparring and fighting and stuff like that, you come face to face with how reflexive and just kind of almost out of control you are. Now, your nervous system, it's done us a big service and as a species, and it got us to survive, because in the middle of a crisis or something going down, it's going to fight, flight, or freeze. It's going to do what it needs to do to survive. Now, long term, it doesn't make good choices. It only makes quick, short-term choices. So when I started to roll and wrestle with these upper belts in jujitsu, I was a bigger guy at the time, and these guys are smaller, and they're just handing me my ass left and right. And they're patient, and they know what's happening before I do. And it wasn't just a matter of skill. It was a matter of they were fighting their own instincts because they had trained through them. They knew their instincts weren't serving them long-term. You know, as a beginner white belt, you'll put your hands, if somebody puts their hand on your shoulder, you immediately go to grab their hand because you think it's a threat. It's not a threat. And when I went to go grab their hand, I totally exposed myself on the other side, and now I'm getting choked out. You're not wired to be smart in the long-term. You're wired to do things that are more emotional and reflexive to just survive whatever this little mini crisis is in front of you. That was the big aha moment. And then you start to learn how to not take the bait. Then you learn how to take a breath instead of just acting on stuff. You know, you just kind of just bring your nervous system down. That turned into yoga, and that turned into meditation. And then it turned into, you know, running and fitness and all that stuff. It's all related. And it's all just a matter of you exposing your nervous system to new stimuli so you can learn to be more resilient and to respond instead of react.
Well, and I think that ties back to your white belt, black belt analogy. There's white belt thinking, there's black belt thinking. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that? You've touched on it here a little bit, but can you go deeper into that?
To be honest, it was a lot of it's just a marketing, you know, way to tell people a story. I'm not even a black belt. I was a three-stripe brown belt when I stopped, but it took me 14 years to get there. That was the thing that and that's one of the things about that white belt, black belt thing is, like, I remember going into jujitsu, and I'm asking on day one, I was like, well, how long does it take to get a black belt? You know, that's white belt thinking. You know, like, the black belt's going to mean anything. Like, your 9-year-old who's got a black belt in karate is actually a good fighter. No, he's just a 9-year-old who's been taking karate. The business side of that karate class gave him the black belt, right? But in jujitsu, I was like, and not to insult anybody's 9-year-old with a black belt, your kid worked really, really hard. Just don't throw him in an octagon and think that, oh, he's got a black belt. That means something. It is what it is. But in jujitsu, it's like, it's going to take you 15 years to get a black belt. I'm like, what? 15 years? What the hell is that about? It's because that's how long it takes to be considered a master in, you know, something like this. You know, that's what they want. So the first thing, you know, you learn is from white belt to black belt is just, this is a journey. You need to be process oriented. Forget the belt. Just learn and it'll come. That's probably the biggest thing that I learned. And that was just, okay, that takes away the anxiety. That takes off the pressure a little bit. So knowing that people inherently want results too quickly. And then the other thing was, you know, the big one, it was the reflexive state of the human experience. You almost feel like a billiard ball until you train to be different. Then you started to get into the health of your body and how strength and mobility really become something that can't be divorced from health. Let's put it this way. If you go to an older person and you take away their car, they freak out. Why do they freak out? Because they lost their mobility. They lost their means to get around. Now, the truth of the matter is their body is their real vehicle. And if we all thought about that first, we would be able to drive a lot longer. Strength as well protects us from breaking down too soon. And you realize that when you're getting, when, you know, when you're wrestling and sparring and all that kind of stuff. Technique is great, but you have to have some type of physical competency to manage life. You can be very intelligent, and there's plenty of people who do very well that aren't necessarily physical competent. And I'm not saying you need to be a professional athlete. I'm just saying you need to be moving the needle into using your machine better. It's your choice. You don't, like I said, you don't have to be a professional athlete, but you do need to make the effort as opposed to just laying back and just letting nature take its course with your body. And then some of the other things that I really learned was that, you know, simplicity is the kind of the height of sophistication. You learn all of these moves for years and years and years, only to come back around and use the same five moves over and over, but you do them very, very well and nobody can stop you. They see it coming. They know that move's coming, but they can't stop it because it's like Muhammad Ali. He's thrown more jabs than people have taken breaths. You know, it's he was going to hit you with it. You just knew that. Vulnerability became a big thing in martial arts. You know, that path to black belt is you realize that if you couldn't be vulnerable, you weren't going to learn fast. That, and I say, the, you know, one of the last biggest thing that I've been sitting here talking for a minute, resiliency. You got to bounce back. You get tapped out many, 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 many times each session. You can't bullshit your way out of it. You just got tapped. And that clarity makes you bounce back. And that's the one thing that athletes, the athletic model, I wasn't an athlete growing up as a kid. I appreciate it more as an adult. But that athletic model teaches you how to deal with loss. If you're a baseball player, say you're a professional baseball player, 160 some games a year, you're going to lose a lot of them. You're going to have to learn how to deal with that. Most of us really, really stay away from anything that would be considered a loss. We just keep it at a different place. And, you know, when we're older, we need to deal with that, be able to learn how to bounce back.
We're hopefully going to get a chance to talk to Becky Allen, and she has a podcast called Win the Day. And I don't know if that's going to be this season or next season, but I like that idea of Win the Day because, listen, you got 365 days a year, and using that baseball analogy, hopefully you win the majority of them. Some of them you might lose, right? But then it's a matter of, you know, do you want a winning season? Do you want to be a contender? If I'm going to continue on with that sports analogy, I like that idea of when you take away an older person's car, they lose their mobility. When we talked to Brian on the base in summer session 8, he talked about how it's losing his independence, and he doesn't ever want to lose his independence. And that's why he switches up his workout routine, that kind of thing too. I spend way more time on mobility now than I have in my entire life. Like, most of my workouts now revolve around mobility, and then I try to throw in some strength training along in there too, because for 25 years, I focused on strength training and absolutely no mobility, and I feel a little rickety these days, you know, so that's important to have. And I also like this idea of simplicity, because I've been on a couple different podcasts now, episodes that I'll share when those air, and I find myself talking so much that I start to question, do I really understand this concept? Because if I did understand this concept, wouldn't I be able to say it in far fewer words? I actually have always struggled with guests who give very quick answers, because when they finish what they're saying, I'm caught off guard because I expect them to go on and on and on. And then when they just wrap it up, I'm like, oh, wait, can you say it again? I missed it. Like, I was doing too many things and I wasn't present. So I love everything that you talked about right there, because it takes such a cerebral approach. And I like that your podcast features you, a personal trainer, but you also include a therapist. So why is erasing that line between mental health and physical health so important to you guys?
You know, that was kind of the tagline we nailed down. You know, you've heard this term mind-body before. It's something that, you know, started really picking up about 20 years ago. Martial arts really kind of drove that home for me, as well as my own fitness journey, is that if you're healthy, you feel good, you do good. If you feel bad, you do bad. There's nothing, you look at people with chronic pain, and some people are really champs about it. But man, if you have a headache, right, you'll make it through your day. But really, how'd you feel, right? Your physical sensations override your mental outlook, your worldview. I think like a lot of the people who are hurting in this world and the people who are the most angry, and they're not in their bodies a lot of times. They're in their head, and their head's stewing, and it's spinning this story, this cycle around. And until they redistribute some of that energy into their bloodstream and then get their bodies going, it just sits and becomes stagnant in their head. That's what was happening to me. And my anxiety took a great turn upward when I started getting into my body. Same thing with, you know, just my worldview in general. And there's plenty of data out there and studies from Harvard to Mayo Clinic about mental health and how it ties in with exercise. Any therapist worth their weight in salt, the first thing they're going to ask their client, are you exercising? Because what happens to the brain chemically during movement is profound. Your brain's first line of code is to move, to survive. And now you live in a sedentary society where you're constantly, you know, absorbing data visually and audibly, and your brain's trying to process that, and it's just an overload. And you just can't sit there in your head. You've got to be a human being with two legs, two arms, bones, vertebrae, all that kind of stuff. You are born to move. And when you don't move, you will have some type of negative symptoms mentally. Your head's in your body. I mean, it's so simple that why are we even questioning it? The question is like almost like silly to me now. Like, how could it not be?
I like that. So we're going to let everybody digest that for a minute, and we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to continue talking to Eric about this idea of living better and dying slower. Thank you for listening to the Mindful Midlife Crisis.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. New episodes come out every Wednesday to help you get over the midweek hump. If you'd like to contact me, or if you have suggestions about what you'd like to hear on the show, visit www.mindfulmidlifecrisis.com and click Contact Us. While you're there, don't forget to sign up for the newsletter to get free weekly meditations as well as free resources from our Reflect, Learn, Grow program. You can also click on the show notes for links to the articles and resources we reference throughout the show. If you want to check out my worldly adventures, follow me on Instagram at mindful_midlife_crisis. My hope is that my trials, tribulations, and successes will inspire you to take intentional action to live a more purpose-filled life. And while you're at it, remember to show yourself some love every now and then, too. Thanks again. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. We are here with Eric Romanak. He is the author of Live Better, Die Slower. You can also find him on his podcast, A Therapist and a Trainer. Eric, we were just talking here about erasing this line between mental health and physical health. You just said a minute ago here off air that you do go to a therapist, but you go every now and then just kind of like a check-in. And I think even BetterHelp has BetterHelp or whatever they are, they have a slogan that says, you know, therapy, you can go in every once in a while and it's like checking the oil in your car, changing the oil in your car. And it sounds like that's kind of how you use therapy.
Yeah, right. Right now it is. Things are going well. There's no crisis management that I'm going through. I think it's a great thing to have somebody who doesn't know you or isn't invested in your day-to-day, just to kind of be a sounding board. I'll be honest, I've yet to have really the type of therapist that challenges me, or maybe I just haven't said anything that needed to be overly challenged. The reason it's helped me is just because it's my time to talk, prompt you with a question, and then I get to hear my thoughts out loud. And sometimes I hear those thoughts and I say them out loud. I was like, well, that's not really how I feel. That was just something that I put together in my head. And now that I say it out loud, that's not it. You know, and then I get to process that a little bit more and kind of really get to the meat of maybe how I do feel about a situation that might be a little convoluted.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I do feel like if you have a thought that's in your head, and it's stewing up there, then it becomes a belief or it becomes a narrative. But if you express it out loud, if you express it verbally, or I even found, that's why I think journaling is so great. I even found that if I type it and I read it, I'm like, oh, what? Like, I'm embarrassed that I even said that or that I even wrote that. So like, why am I having that thought? It's not as catastrophic as I'm making it out to be in my head now that I read it and now that I see it. And I think that's the oil change, is that you get those narratives and you get those thoughts that are self-limiting out of your head so that they don't manifest into belief systems that then dictate your behavior. What's your relationship like with the therapist that's on your show, Justin Lewis? How does he challenge you to reframe situations? What have you learned from working with him on the podcast?
Oh, this is going to be funny because I'm going to have to tell Justin to listen to this just for this little segment. I have a different relationship with Justin. Justin is more like a friend, and we started, you know, professionally, but now we run together and all that kind of stuff. Justin and I are just very, very different people. My relationship with him is very positive. I enjoy his company. I enjoy the differences that we have, but I like me. I like the way I do me.
Do you find yourself then defaulting to antagonism with him?
100%. Dude, here's the thing, man. I am bored as shit. I am like most people, like people don't want to get into the meat of life. You know, they just kind of, how's the weather? Oh, it's fine. I don't like talking politics because everybody has a different belief and they're all a little bit valid and they all kind of annoy me equally. But with Justin, since we're so different, and the thing about Justin is a great sport. Like, he is a really, really fun person to be around, and I like him for that. So we purposefully kind of have that antagonistic relationship, and that is, it's very entertaining to me. So I keep him around for entertaining purposes.
That's good to have. I feel like maybe the athlete in you goes for the competitive sparring, and the therapist in him goes for the intellectual sparring.
Yeah, he does. That's a good way to put it. He's good at that, and he's good at pointing out something that doesn't vibe, you know, with maybe something I've said before. You know, he's kind of got like one of those elephant memories too. And I'm like, oh, you little son of a bitch, you got me. And I like to think that I'm a good sport when he gets me. We laugh a lot. One of the things I miss about my youth is the way, you know, boys behave with each other. You get into a group of guys nowadays and everybody's kind of, you know, they've been married, they've had kids, and, you know, they're kind of a little bit subdued on that boyish energy. And I do like when I can find somebody who will be that way with me.
You clearly didn't work in education because you'd get real sick of that boyish energy.
Maybe. Very true. Yeah, that's a luxury of mine.
So one thing that you talked about in the podcast that I found really fascinating, and I know you're not an expert in this, but I wanted you to dive into game theory a bit because, like I said, I just found it really fascinating. And when you discussed it, it makes me want to learn more about this idea specifically behind the finite game and an infinite game. So I believe it's Simon Sinek, this is what the work is based on. So can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that? And then that way we can refer everybody to Simon Sinek's actual work.
Yeah, I heard it from him, or maybe it was a guy named Naval Ravikant, who is kind of like a Silicon Valley type of guy, pretty smart dude. The idea between finite games and infinite games. So finite games are like baseball. There's 9 innings, right? There's a score at the end. There's a winner and there's a loser. You have a declared number of people on the field. It's a very contained, rule-oriented situation. And those are the games that we have grown up with most of the time. Now, an infinite game is something that is quite different. An infinite game is players come and go, and there are people who are winning sometimes, people who are losing sometimes, and it keeps going on and on and on. And the point of that game is to stay in the game. One of the things that seems to be happening to us psychologically as a society, especially as you know, how we developed economically, is that we try to view things as you stomp out the competition, you kill them, and you know, you move on into the next person and you conquer and stomp. And next thing you know, you got these big, massive conglomerates, and you know, that's where things go. What really can happen though is that you can find that you are like the pie is really big, essentially. You don't necessarily need to view your competitors as somebody who needs to be put out of its misery, because a competitor makes you better. You know, and then also a competitor can be somebody who gives you great ideas. And if they're gone, you become dull. You can use a lot of psychology things to kind of help yourself and how you're viewing your own life. Is everybody somebody who needs to be stomped out? And they're these, I just want the game to be over. I mean, what then? You know, we as a society really kind of have to, I think, and I'm kind of, these are just kind of big ideas and worldviews that I can't flesh out. I'm not an economist or a world leader by any means, but you know, it's like we're all just trying to get along and just stay alive. You know, we live in a great time where we all inhabit the same planet. Civilization's a team sport, sure, but you know, you don't want to get rid of all the teams. It's almost like this is just heady shit, and I'm nobody. I'm a guy who lives in Paducah, Kentucky. That's the area of my expertise, is just trying to stay in the game. And that's what I do.
Well, I like that. And I mean, that perfectly reflects this idea of live better and die slower. It's just, I'm trying to stay in the game. I was listening to Lori Seitz episode 43. If you want to go back and listen to that one, she was on another podcast called Midlife Mastery. I'm actually going to be on that one. It was a lot of fun being on that episode. And she said something that I didn't necessarily agree with, because she said, if you're not growing, you're dying. And in my head, I'm like, well, we're always kind of like dying, you know, kind of going back to what you said. I look at it as, if you're not growing, you're dying faster, right? That you're regressing in some way, shape, or form. So I spun it that way. And I like this idea of, you know, just trying to stay in the game. But then I do feel we have some sense of responsibility to help others stay in the game in some capacity. And maybe it's not mental health, maybe it's not physical health, but just through being supportive in whatever capacity that is, that we can support others.
Yeah. You know, looking at your fellow man as a threat or as a companion and a teammate, you know, that's a very clearly definitive line. And I've heard in, you know, mental health that, you know, people who've suffered from trauma tend to create behaviors of protection instead of connection. And I think that, you know, human existence is tough. And, you know, we definitely all grow up with micro traumas to severe traumas. And we don't necessarily default to being a connected species. We default as in protect ourselves. And that is our hardwiring. And it always will be. So the thing that we see, I look at, you know, health, our grandparents and parents and great-grandparents, they were building a country. And thank God they did. The fact that you and I can sit here and talk about anything about the content of macronutrients and all that kind of stuff and exercising before and after work, what a luxury, what a world we live in that we can think about taking care of ourselves that way. There was a lot of people who were not eligible to do that because what they did. You know, I kind of try to keep myself in check with that. But to look at your fellow man and to try to unite the human species in any way, shape, or form, whether it's economically, internationally, or just through shared values, you know, that is one of the things that we are looking at right now much more differently than we ever have before. You know, we have all these cultures on the planet. We got 7 billion people, but the one thing that we all share is health. Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to feel pain. Everybody would rather feel better. I would say my standard line is a healthy society consists of healthy individuals. Until health becomes a distinct value of our country, of our communities, of our planet, we're going to be unhealthy. And if we're going to be unhealthy, you know where that train's going. It's going to go into pain. It's going to go into more suffering. It's going to go into protectionism and all these kind of things. So, yeah, you know, we'll figure it out, or we won't. I just do my part.
Well, I think that segues perfectly into this last question that I have for you here.
You know, in what way is vitality the ultimate human currency?
I think the best way to answer that is I would ask that question to somebody who's in a hospital bed and say, what would you like right now more than anything else? And they say, I just want to feel better. Take it away and you'll know that you don't have it. Same thing with older people. Just watch the way people interact with their lives. They're either moping along through it or they're fucking crushing it. And the difference is what's going through their veins. Vitality is a biological juice, and there's a way to cultivate it. There's also a way to drain it, and it's physical. And it is mental, but it's physical first. It starts with blood. It starts with hormones, you know, and movement creates those pathways. You can even go on a diet. You can eat relatively clean and healthy, but if you don't move your body, the nutrients will not get to the rest of the body. That is just goes to show you how movement is life. You can't drink stagnant water. Basic life 101, move or die. Even if you think about what is the best thing to do to prevent dementia and brain deterioration, it is more sophisticated movement patterns. You want your grandma to have a sharper brain? Put her in a dance class, right? Forget the Sudoku puzzles. Teach them how to do different dexterity things with their fingers, play a new instrument, all that kind of stuff. Their brain's going to light up because the first line of code is to move or die. So when you re-stimulate that code, the whole brain starts to wake up. And that is something that we cannot forget, that movement creates vitality, and vitality is the currency that moves us through life and all the things we're trying to get from it.
I think that move or die is your mic drop right there. So, Eric, I really appreciate you taking the time here to chat with us. If you want to hear more from Eric, go to his podcast, A Therapist and a Trainer. We will link that in the show notes. We will also link his book, Live Better, Die Slower, in the show notes as well. Be sure to check that out. Pick that up. Eric, thanks, man. It was great talking to you.
This is great talking to you, man. I really appreciate you having me.
So for Eric, this is Billy. Thank you for listening to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. May you feel happy, healthy, and loved. Take care, friends.